I have read your paper that you just gave.
You want another copy? I got a pile of them over there.
I'd be delighted to have one.
I did it sort of as a fun thing. Part-time, and I wanted to get into the record a bibliography of some of our work, a lot of which does not apply to high-energy propellants. But the first 177 references sort of is a history of all of it, is a list of all of our output, and a number of which do apply to energy propellants. The first, the first 60 directly apply to high energy propellants. I refer to some of them. After 177, I started adding references for this particular paper. I hope that in your Saturn history, you'll be sure to talk to Silverstein. The punchline of this paper, of course, is the fact that based on our work on hydrogen and his confidence in hydrogen and oxygen, he almost single-handedly made the decision to use hydrogen oxygen in the upper stages of Saturn.
Along that same line, you say you single-handedly, did other members of the Silverstein Committee oppose?
No, I don't think they did. Other members were Colonel Apole, Abe Hyatt, and Cal Muse, and George Sutton, Eldon Hall, and Werner von Braun. And at the luncheon prior to giving this paper, Werner told me that Abe almost single-handedly made the decision. It didn't take too much persuasion, I assume. Because, as I said in the paper, he was chairman of the committee. He was also director of space flight development, and so was in the top NASA position to make the decision. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he was convinced that hydrogen and oxygen was the right way to go. All contributed. Now, he had a strong ally, and that is Eldon Hall, who was the secretary of that panel, had made a number of calculations on the performance of various propellants in upper stages of Saturn, and Hall was convinced that hydrogen and oxygen was the way to go, and he, in turn, had an influence on Silverstein. Abe came by to see me after I gave this paper, in fact it was last week, and suggested that if I wanted to follow up and dig a little deeper, I ought to get some more information from Hall and some others. Incidentally, Emmy wants me to revise this paper and enlarge it and perhaps get Silverstein to help contribute and give it next October to the IAF session in Vienna. Mm-hmm. I talked to Abe Silverstein about that when he came by last week, and he felt he would not have much time to contribute personally, but he'd be he would be interested in doing what he did have time to do, and suggested I go ahead and do a little research and see what I could dig up.
Do you happen to have the appendices to the Silverstein report? We have a copy of the report that I think you sent over to Gene's shop, but we don't have the...
No, it's the other way around. Gene sent me a copy, and so what I've got is a copy of the report that Emmy got from von Braun. And it's in two parts. One is a summary part that was to the administrator. The other is the full report, I thought.
Yeah, that's what we're trying to find.
And Emmy, sent me a copy of that, so he should have it. You know,
just the summary.
You have it here?
No, I've got it at home, I think. I'll have to dig that out for you. But Emmy had them both because that's where I got mine. Abe let me see his copy sometime several years ago. I don't know where it is. Abe mentioned that he had chaired a study for the Department of Defense on rocket systems in the 56 or 57 period. And I'm going to look that up and try to track it down. He didn't know much more than that.
Deal with concern with liquid hydrogen?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He also chaired a panel that led to Centaur. But that's another story.
That's it.
He asked that if I wanted to pursue the hydrogen story to any greater extent, then I ought to check out those two as well as the paper that you were referring to.
In the process of the work at Lewis, I was very much interested in the injector design. You mentioned the coaxial injector.
Sure. Now, you've hit an Achilles heel in my memory. I wrote it from memory as coaxial, and then I changed it before I gave it a shower head, and this one shows it as shower head.
Hmm.
That's the note on page 12.
Mm-hmm.
And I called over and told Emmy before I distributed this I wanted to check that one word as to whether it was coaxial or shower head, and I was going to do that by checking the references. I did check one reference. And in fact, I've checked three since then, and I'm pretty sure of my ground it was a shower head. It was a very fine shower head. By that, I mean we used a hell of a lot of holes.
Mm-hmm.
And the references that will tell you that are the ones that I'm going to look up are numbers...
Forty-eight and 56, according to the note here. Was that
the 48th, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
56, the one over here by Douglas and Hennings and Price.
Right. Now, I know we used the shower head. In fact, I think the coaxial came in much later. I'm pretty positive that it is the shower head.
Why did you go from the shower head to the coaxial in later design studies?
Coaxial is harder to make than the shower head. The difference between the two is a matter of engineering design. The coaxial is just one tube within another, and the big problem is how do you keep the tube. The annulus around the tube constant. You have to have spacers or something of this sort. With the shower head, we didn't have that problem. We had a much better control. And our design concept was to get an intimate mixing of the fuel and oxidizer by using a hell of a lot of holes.
Mm-hmm.
So the shower head was a very fine shower head. That is, we had a hell of a lot of hydrogen and oxygen. Broken into very fine spray. If you're familiar with shower heads, which some of the luxury types have a hell of a lot of holes and feel like a real soft, velvety feel when you're under one like that.
But the RL-10 design used kind of a coaxial injector design, didn't they?
The RL-10, actually. No, I think and I'm not dead sure of that, they used the oxygen, came through tubes, then the hydrogen came through the face, which essentially is like a shower head.
Yeah, but I thought that face, too, it was had some coaxial things. About 5% of the hydrogen was used for cooling across the face.
I'd have to look back.
Yeah.
You may be more right than I. I'd
yeah.
have to check.
Yeah.
But I don't think so. I think theirs was first, like I said. Are you defining coaxial the same way I am?
Okay, maybe that's the problem.
I'm a lousy artist. Let's say this is the injector face, and I won't worry about two dimensions. Our shower head looked like this. Let's see. Say the oxygen was in this chamber, and it came through the injector face, came in here.
Mm-hmm.
Then the hydrogen came into this and came through a lot of holes that surrounded this.
Okay, that's, yeah, okay.
Now,
I
if you had a coaxial, it would be two tubes. This would be the hydrogen tube, and this would be the oxygen tube. And if you were to look at these, it'd be like this.
Okay.
And if you were to look at this, you would see a discrete series of holes.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, unless you have a spacer with this, if this tube, due to heating or imperfect installation, wanders over, why you'll to give you an exaggeration, you'll get something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost impossible, if you were to look in under a magnification, to have one like this unless it has spacers.
Yeah, okay. And as I recall, the final injector design for the RL-10 and the J-2 was more along this line, but they actually had a...
They used a rigid mesh.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask
and
you about.
And you see,
too,
that's essentially this kind of a design,
yeah,
rather than coaxial, in my way of thinking. They had their, instead of their hydrogen flowing through in a bunch of tiny, small holes, it flew through millions of them in this mesh.
You know,
which was sort of a diffusion of hydrogen.
Where that rigid mesh design and concept came from?
No, I don't. We used porous wall film cooling years ago, and it may have come from that. And there was a lot of work on that sort of thing, both at Lewis and at JPL.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we would make a rocket engine out of porous metal, called transpiration cooling, and then the water would, or sweat cooling, the water would come through the porous metal and vaporize on the inner surface and keep the wall cool. Well, rigid mesh, I think, is a trade name for a controlled porosity type of metal wall that was made, and I think they, of course, were aware of this kind of work. Quite a few people did this. In fact, even been some of it done in aerodynamic things to control boundary layers and things like this. So I don't know where they got the idea, but it was probably like a lot of other things, evolution of thinking on their part.
Well, you talk about your shower head design here then as being very successful. Could you make some comments as to what was different about it, or what made it so much better than previous designs?
Well, the fact that it was a very fine scale type of shower head.
Mm-hmm.
By that I mean used many, many small holes. And also I think the characteristics of hydrogen, the fact we're using hydrogen as a coolant, and the velocity of the hydrogen, plus the fine scale.
And if you recall, and this was used in some of the early RL-10 engine design.
Yes, although there's a man down here in town who, Charlie King, who works for NASA, who you probably ought to discuss that with, who was in on the early days of that.
Mm-hmm.
Pratt and Whitney visited us three times, or I have a record somewhere of the dates they visited us. And at one time, and this is pure recollection, they claimed they openly borrowed our injector design. And, but I haven't in my mind the exact evolution of their own design and how they went through. This is from Lewis. Yeah.
They said they just borrowed it from Lewis. Yeah.
But Rocketdyne, did they have any people visiting those?
Oh, yeah.
Do you know anybody by name?
Well, had Tom Myers, one of the, I should tell you this, that the NACA Special Subcommittee on Rocket Engines, which was formed in 1950 and ran till NASA 58, always had a North American Rocketdyne representative, had Bell representatives, had PMW, I recall. I think it had a PMW. And we met 2 to 3 times, 4 times a year, and we always reviewed our programs every time, and they in turn reviewed theirs, and we had a very intimate commerce of communication and informal communication at the worker level with these companies. NACA was viewed as a friend to all with no axe to objective, no axe to grind, and so they freely gave us access to what they were doing and kept up with what we were doing. And we have to have a steady stream of visitors to our place. Tom Myers, if I recall, was the rocket, the North American representative on our subcommittee, and one of the prominent people in it. And we visited them a number of times. I would have to go back to some of my earlier papers to name a few more. I forget where the Castle Holt was there at that time or not. Fellow that works now for NASA was strong in their combustion oscillations. And Thompson, R.J. Thompson, who was our chief scientist for years, probably still is, was always active in our work and followed it. Bob came from M.W. Kellogg, and they had a rocket. And John Torme, who worked in liquid rockets for years and then went over in the solid rockets, was close to our work. There were a few others, but their names escaped me.
Would you make some comments about the...
I was incidentally on the J2 source selection. I was on the F1 and the J2.
Okay, could you just tell us about the J2 source selection, design, and things like that?
I really don't recall anything of great moment that would do for you on that. It seems to me that I had my papers, source selection for the F1 returned to me about 4 or 5 years ago. Perhaps if I went through those, it would jog my memory. Tischler would be your best man on that because he's here in the
Tischler.
He was the chief honcho for that work at headquarters at the time. And I think he'd be a better source. What is it you want to know?
Well, almost anything, as a matter of fact.
You have to reconstruct the whole story.
One of the things that John and I are interested in, too, is where the technology came from, say, for the J2, and did it come out of Lewis? Did they borrow from Pratt & Whitney? Did they pick up stuff from the H1, you know, that could have fit on the J2? And what kind of design problems did they get into, and how did they resolve them, and this kind of thing? Or almost just anything you remember about this particular thing.
The background for hydrogen oxygen is fairly broad. You're familiar with the work that went on Ohio State.
Okay, I wanted to ask you about that. Johnston here, yeah.
Johnston.
You want to start with him? Could you tell us more about him?
Johnston was a very brilliant professor who did excellent work in cryogenics, in hydrogen liquefaction. He had a number of students, graduate students, and he had quite a sizable cryogenic laboratory going. His design was used by Aerojet for their hydrogen liquefaction plant. you're familiar with this recent history that came out on Heritage.
Yeah, three guys. I forgot. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
I read the damn thing. I thought it was loud paper.
Okay, first
time. I had to read to the damn last page before I found what I wanted, namely when the hell they ran the engine. And my own notes were better than that, because I said in a paper in 1963 that they ran the engine in 1949, 3,000 pounds. And the thing that disappointed me, and this is an aside, is the prime mover in the Aerojet hydrogen work was a man named Dave Young, not Robert Young, David Young. And hell, he's referenced in the papers in the end, but I couldn't find his name anywhere in the whole paper. We came across, well, I'm diverting, going back to Johnston. He was strong in thermodynamic properties. Gradually added at Ohio State. They had a German, Rudolph, forget his last name. He was a very good kineticist in combustion. And Lauren Bollinger, who is deceased, was the prime mover in their little rocket lab. They built a small rocket lab. Their rocket lab was established about 1946. In fact, I've got a paper somewhere. The history of the Ohio State Rocket Lab. It's only a few sentences, but it said it established in 46. Apparently, I picked it up on a trip to Ohio State. I saw that rocket facility, and it was primary student power, labor, and so forth. Mm-hmm. And it was small scale, but as I recall, they operated. Wrote a paper in 1952 or 3, I think I read. And I ran across it while I was writing this paper. Let's see if I can find it. Didn't I reference that in here?
Okay, let's go to
1951. All right. I haven't read that paper in a long time, but that might give you a good lead. I ran across it in doing research for this paper. They ran hydrogen oxygen prior to 51, but at least that's one of their reports, and it'll give you a lead on other reports. Mm-hmm. Okay. So much for Johnson.
But he came up to Cleveland then and helped you do some of your work? Or
no,
his
we always looked upon Johnston as a source we negotiated with him to get some liquid hydrogen. He was liquefying hydrogen, and we were trying to negotiate to have it hauled in a door by truck from his facility to Lewis. It never panned out.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a complex individual. Was also consulting and was strong in hydrogen liquefaction process. And his design was used by Aerojet, as we mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the first experimental hydrogen oxygen that I became aware of was in 1945 when 46, when there was a sweat cooling symposium at Wright Field. And at that symposium, Dave Young gave a paper on seems to me it was a 1,000-pound or 500-pound thrust hydrogen-oxygen rocket. And it was a tiny thing, and it was porous wall cooled, and it was built just like this. Simple. And if I recall, he hadn't run it, but this was his design. And this was part of the same contract that is well recorded in the history we referred to. And the Navy, under Navy sponsorship, they ran a 3,000-pound thrust rocket. Incidentally, I thought they ran the rocket pump and and thrust chamber at the same time, but they never could find that back out from that tape. All I got was the two had been operated. But I think they did cobble them together and claim that they ran
in
order to satisfy the requirements of the contract.
Yeah.
They had a hell of a lot of trouble. Okay. So Aerojet was strong in JPL did a little work kind of thing. And those were the only ones I recall that were in.
Did you ever meet Walter Stetthalter at the Rocket Dyne? Is that name? He was at one time one of the program managers on the J2, and I was curious about his background.
By the way, president, Sam Hoffman, former president of Rocket Dyne, was with me on this panel, and he's retired now. He'd be a good source of information because he was in the company during the time of the J2, a key place. And the chief engineer, whose name escapes me right now, would be another excellent contact.
Brennan? Bill Brennan, buddy?
I think Brennan came later.
Yeah. Paul Katzenholz.
He came later, too. Yeah. Okay. I'd have to look in the old papers.
What were the special design features of the J2 as you see them?
Well, the thing about hydrogen oxygen that each investigator found out was it's a damn easy combination to run. There was a lot of psychological fear of hydrogen from its explosive characteristics, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Its flammability in oxygen is from 4 to 96%.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a great deal of reluctance to work with. And of course, the Zeppelin experience had everybody psyched out on it. But once you started using it, it became amazingly simple. Easy to burn, easy to cool. And I think each person found this out. In other words, it's hard as hell to foul yourself up when you're working with hydrogen. You do it decently. To go to the other extreme, one of the worst combinations man had to ever fight with was nitric acid gasoline at Bell. And it's a bastard. Just have to. Everything, the injector is critical, and everything about it is so critical to get the thing to perform decently. Hydrogen oxygen on the other hand, it's a real nice combination to work with. And of course, we were after hydrogen oxygen, but we had our sights set on fluorine hydrogen.
Yeah.
And we had a hell of a. When we got around to hydrogen oxygen, it was a piece of cake. After all the difficulties we had with chlorine.
My car, did I get caught by going to chlorine or not?
Yeah, you get
that trade-off to make a whole new system to do
that?
If you already have
the answer to your question is, historically, is obviously not, because we got one and don't have the other. But chlorine had two things going for it. One, or three things. One, its density was 1.5 times that of oxygen. Two, it used less hydrogen. Therefore, the density combination was great. And three, it was spontaneously ignitable. And so we thought these were great factors. The trouble with chlorine is it's too damn active and reactive for common use. But all those things help. Its actual performance in terms of specific impulse is not that much greater. It is some, but it's what I recall 15 or 20 units at altitude. We go from 420 or so specific impulse to 450.